World Crisis Radio. I am your host, Webster G. Tarpley, broadcasting from Washington, D.C., bringing you in the first hour another panorama of the ongoing breakdown crisis of imperialism as the Anglo-American Empire heads towards catastrophe in the short to medium term. And in the second hour, we'll be joined by the very popular and very knowledgeable radio host, Maria Heller, someone whose work on the Internet is known to many of our listeners, someone who has also taken a leading role in the 9/11 truth movement. And maybe with the help of Maria and some callers, we can put together an idea of where the much-battered 9/11 truth movement should go from here. Let me just point out, before I go any further, that if you want to hear more from me around the middle of the week, you can hear me on Rents, the Jeff Rents radio program. That will be Thursday, December 7th, from 10 p.m. Eastern time until about midnight Eastern time, and correspondingly across the time zones. That's going to be a an appearance this coming week on Rents, Jeff Rents' program, many topics to be covered. I also commend to your kind attention 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism, my book on the subject. As far as Amazon.com was concerned, it was the champion for October, at least. The November figures are not yet in, as far as I know, but I'm sure it's also going to keep a leading position among the studies. And I have to tell you that I think the chapter on Angel is Next in that book is more and more urgent, especially because many of the other authorities in the field seem to be ignoring this absolutely crucial piece of political evidence, the most important piece of political evidence in the entire day. And my headline for a discussion that I'd like to have later in this hour: if you're not talking about Angel is Next, you are simply dodging the main political feature of the entire public record of 9/11. And we'll get to that in just a minute. Let's look first, before our first break is over here, the death agony of the U.S. dollar proceeds apace. Since around Thanksgiving, we have been in a phase of aggravated collapse of the dollar. It's very significant that the military collapse and political collapse of the U.S. effort in Iraq, the crisis of imperialism, as we have outlined it, is going together with a crisis in the value of the leading imperialist currency. And we'll tell you more about that when we come back in just a minute here on RBN Live, Republic Broadcasting. Crisis Radio here on Republic Broadcasting Network, your host, Webster Tarpley, broadcasting from Washington, D.C., and of course we're streaming worldwide at rbnlive.com. We are on a shortwave in the 25-meter band at 12.180 megacycles, and we are also available to the happy few localities, increasingly less few, in the form of low-power FM community radio. Let's look at the death agony of the dollar. This is broken out again. We were talking about this a lot in the springtime with the collapse of the yen carry trade, the coming of the Russian trading system that allows you to buy rubles, gold, buy oil, gold, and grain with Russian rubles, and other moves by Iran and others which have not yet come as far as they had intended to, but the collapse of the dollar again goes together with the military collapse of the U.S. position in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere around the world. As of right now, the dollar is going for, well, it's for a euro, you have to put up 1.3335 U.S. dollars, $1.34 approximately. That is a 20-month low for the dollar compared to the euro. Even more dramatic, it is a 14-year low compared to the British pound. And that takes us back to September 1992 when Soros shorted the British pound and destroyed the European rate mechanism, the temporary precursor of the euro. So 20-month low vis-a-vis the euro, 14-year low vis-a-vis the pound. The dollar is down approximately 7% this year. The dollar is down 2% just in the last week. The hedge fund operators are reported to be hysterical, and of course what faces them is no mystery. We've got to go back to long-term capital management, that famous hedge fund using the Black-Scholes derivatives models went belly up in September 1990, multi-dollar, the banking system, and the dollar is looming right now, is a possible rout of the U.S. dollar. Remember, the U.S. is a deficit in excess of $800 billion and possibly approaching $1 trillion in this year of 2006 calendar year. We should remind ourselves that the U.S. is a net foreign debtor owing at least $4 trillion, if not $5 trillion. China has, and Arabia has $1 trillion. There is a gross total of $13 trillion of U.S. paper in the hands of foreigners, and that's a key magnitude, because as the dollar goes down, $13 trillion times 2% lost in the past week is a hefty sum. Nobody wants to eat losses. The European Central Bank is scheduled to meet this coming week. It is very likely that they will raise their interest rates by 0.25%, making the situation for the dollar even worse. The Bank of England is going to meet next week. They may do it, although it seems to be a little bit less likely. The European Central Bank just carried out a very interesting support for all forms of bank paper, including their own, dumping 23 tons of gold on the market, but the gold price has continued to climb, as you can see from day to day. We're told by economists that as the dollar goes down, U.S. exports will increase, and that will help the U.S. economy. Too bad. All those factories are long gone. There are no factories left to export anything. Can't be manufactured, can't be produced, can't be exported. The cliche mongers of academic economics are, as usual, flailing. Everybody in the world is looking at the dollar and wondering when they should bolt for the exit, when that panic flight out of the dollar will begin. This is now just a question of time. Notice that there are real economic factors, extremely dramatic ones. Detroit has lost something approaching half of all of its jobs just in the last year, as bankrupt General Motors and bankrupt Ford have been buying out tens of thousands of employees. And the more industrial jobs you destroy, the less and less real, physical, tangible wealth there is in terms of production to shore up this bankrupt paper. We're also watching the housing bubble collapse, prices of houses down 4% in the most recent statistics. And this has, of course, the reverse wealth effect. Greenspan had prattled about the wealth effect. Well, now we've got the reverse wealth effect. Walmart sales down in November for one of the first quarters of loss of sales, or first months of loss of sales by Walmart in their entire history. So the entire crazy house of cards is on the brink of panic and a flight for the exits. And of course, it's no coincidence that at this point we hear that if it does come, it'll be the fault of Al-Qaeda. We're told that a cyber attack by Al-Qaeda on the Wall Street computer networks and the Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System is now looming. Again, remember, imperialism is a looting machine enforced by military means. The dollar has no value except what the U.S. military forces can impose in the ultimate analysis. It is not based on production. It's not based on confidence. It is not based on a shared commitment to any kind of economic project. It's pure blackmail, pure arm twisting, and the arm twisting machine is in big trouble. Now, if we look at the Iraq situation, the big news here is that the Bush administration, in its schizophrenia, in its autism, in its arrogance, in its absolute neocon fascistoid fanaticism, is demanding endless war. This brings the question of impeachment and therefore of 9/11 truth as the leading edge of impeachment back into the center of everything. When Bush was visiting the Baltic states, Estonia and Latvia, earlier this week for the NATO summit, he pointed out that there would be no pullout of U.S. forces from Iraq until the mission is completed. He then went to Amman, Jordan, in time to be snubbed by Maliki. We'll hear more about that in a minute. But in Amman, Bush said, "We are staying in Iraq in order to get the job done." Again, what this job is, he's never able to say, but he's adamant there will be no graceful exit. Now, this puts Bush on a collision course with reality and possibly also with realist elements in the U.S. ruling class. We'll look at them in just a minute. He may also be on a collision course with his own party. It is unlikely that the power-mad Republicans, smarting from their most recent defeats, are going to tie themselves to the sinking ship of Bush's Iraq policy. So massive defections against Bush are indeed ongoing in Republican ranks themselves. This actually means that for the first time in a long time, impeachment and similar steps are possible. Now, the Iraq study group, it looked in the days after the election as if they had actually carried out a successful coup d'etat. But now, the Bush neocon group with its criminal energy seems to be fighting back. The Iraq study group seems to be talking about a relatively tepid bureaucratic consensus, a kind of rotten compromise among bureaucratic factions that the U.S. would get out of Iraq by early 2008. And what they mean by out means combat units out. This could mean as many as 70,000 U.S. forces remaining in Iraq in 2008. They would increasingly, according to the leaks from the Baker Hamilton group, they would increasingly take on the role of advisors. And, of course, this is exactly the same nonsense that we saw in Vietnam with Vietnamization and so forth. It's also worth pointing out that the role of the Iraq study group poses all the dangers of a war fought by a committee, fought by an oligarchy. This makes the danger all the greatest. Now, in the background, what we seem to have is a fight between a faction around James Baker III against a faction of George Shultz in the U.S. ruling class. On the one side, we have the Iraq study group with James Baker, the leading personality. And that group, with its general idea that it's time to liquidate the Iraq adventure, let Iraq collapse into some kind of chaos and maybe even a regional war, why not? That perspective is getting support from the moderate imperialists, people like Colin Powell, Jimmy Carter, Senator Chuck Hagel, and others. On the other side, we have the diehard neocon fascist madmen, Cheney's office, Addington, and also such people as Gaffney, of the Washington think tank circuit, Krauthammer, the television commentator Muravchik. We heard from him last week. He wants to attack Iran immediately, as well as the third string or fourth string neocons, Cliff May and Royal Mark Gerecht. This group demands endless war and indeed a wider war. It's very interesting to look at Elliot Abrams. He is now the deputy national security advisor to Bush. He's a convicted felon. And we've got to put that in perspective when people talk about Alcee Hastings or somebody like Murtha. Abrams, a convicted felon. How about that? In the White House. Back in a minute on RBN Live. Crisis Radio here on RBN. Webster Tarpley talking from Washington, D.C. And we're just noting that after the advances made by the Iraq Study Group in their creeping coup in the week or so after the elections, the fascist coalition seems to have stabilized to some degree. We're told that Elliot Abrams is one of the centers of resistance. Elliot Abrams ensconced in the White House as Deputy National Security Advisor of the United States. And this man is a convicted felon, a convicted Iran-Contra criminal. He copped a sweetheart plea. He could have been sent to jail for quite a long time for constitutional crimes. And, of course, Elliot Abrams was pardoned by Bush the Elder back in those infamous series of pardons back in December 1992, along with Weinberger, Claire George, and a bunch of other criminals who were pardoned by Bush at that point. So if people start complaining that Alcee Hastings was impeached, fine, Alcee Hastings was impeached, but never convicted. Abrams is a convicted felon. They say that, oh, the FBI tried to entrap Murtha. Yes, they did, but Abrams is a convicted felon. Speaking of Murtha, he has the clearest position on this. He says, based on what we've heard from the Iraq Study Group is unacceptable because it does not call for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces. He says, basically, the Iraq Study Group is practically the same thing as Bush, says Murtha. The Harrimanite Holbrook seems to be supporting the Iraq Study Group. The U.S. can't influence anything, says Holbrook, who is a candidate for Secretary of State if a Democrat should win. God help us on that one. Now, the options here are clear. The Democratic Party is attempting to hide behind the fig leaf of this rotten Iraq Study Group, an emanation of the invisible government and the ruling elite. There are two things that together add up to a solution to this entire thing. The first is, according to Putin's top advisor, Safonov, Russia is calling for a comprehensive Middle East peace conference. This is the kind of thing where everything would go on the table. Israeli nukes, Iranian nukes, reconstruction of Lebanon, reconstruction of Iraq, repatriation of all foreign troops in the region, the Palestinian state, an independent one, sovereign, and so forth. Anybody with any brains would grab this Russian offer with two hands and their teeth and use it as a means of getting out of Iraq. We also have, from June, the offer by about a dozen Sunni resistance organizations saying that the war could end tomorrow. A ceasefire would be granted immediately if the U.S. simply made a pledge to get out in 2 years. We don't need the rotten ruling class ideologues of the Iraq study group. Rather, what we have to keep our minds set on is the danger that the desperate Cheniac cabal may indeed launch that Iranian attack that they have been striving for lo these many months. We have to look at the calendar every time. The new moon is scheduled for the 9th of December. That is the point of maximum danger when the stealth attacks might occur. On the other hand, the Russian Tor surface-to-air missiles are arriving. So all of these things go into the calculation of whether the Cheney clique is desperate enough and whether they can force this whole thing through. Now, we've had the Bush Maliki farce, this comedy of errors, how humiliating it was for Bush to be snubbed by his own puppet, to be humiliated by Maliki, hoist with his own petard, snubbed by his own puppet. Remember, the sloganeering is always, as the Iraqis stand up, the U.S. will stand down. Well, in this case, it was the Iraqi who stood Bush up. If Maliki had wanted to save himself, he should have gone to the summit and told Bush to get the U.S. forces out immediately. This little snubbing routine that Maliki went through will not save him. He is, needless to say, a dead man walking. He's caught between Alawi, the candidate of the neocons to be a pro-U.S. puppet strongman on the one hand, and Muqtada and this other character, Hakim, on the other hand, the two leading lights of the Shiite bloc. And of course, then you've got Talabani and the Kurds, who are practically separate already. Talabani making his own pilgrimage to Iran. So the U.S. situation in Iraq could hardly be worse. We're going to talk about encirclement and annihilation in just a minute. It's interesting that at this meeting of NATO in Latvia, the Belgian foreign minister, Flau, said, we now need a timetable to get out of Afghanistan. We've got to get out of there. It's clear that the winter offensive is going to take place, and that critical supply road through the Khyber Pass from Peshawar is going to be under tremendous pressure. Encirclement and annihilation waiting there, too, in Afghanistan. Back in a minute on RBN Live. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio here on Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Webster Tarpley broadcasting from Washington, D.C. So we behold the pitiful Bush-Maliki summit. It had no positive result, no outcome of any kind, simply perfunctory. But, of course, it did manage to do serious political damage to Bush because he was stood up, and serious political damage to Maliki, because the Muqtada Shiite group, the Sadr forces, the Mahdi army politicians, have now quit temporarily, at least, the government and the parliament. So we now have the Muqtada effect that the Maliki government has not got a majority, does not have a leg to stand on. He's simply floating in the air. And indeed, it may be that Maliki is now ripe for a coup. It's significant to look at the hapless Bush. He is down, snubbed three or four times. Maliki stands him up. Secondly, with Senator-elect Webb of Virginia. Webb came to a reception at the White House for new senators, and Bush came over with his usual patronizing, demeaning familiarity, asking, how's your boy? Now, everybody knows that Webb's son is serving in Iraq. The only way to interpret this question from Bush is not a polite or even interested query about the welfare of this son of Webb's, but it is necessary to interpret it as a possible death threat. In the era after the death of Senator Wellstone in October 2002, no senator could ever interpret a question from Bush in any other way. This was a threat, and Webb's answer at least had the merit of showing that he's willing to stand up to Bush in some way, right? Basically saying, we want to get the kids out of Iraq, and what goes on between me and my son is none of your business. If the Democratic Party were healthy at that point, Webb would be the leading candidate for the 2008 Democratic nomination, because he's the only Democrat so far who's shown any disposition at all to stand up to Bush. There's also a break with the endless narcissism of the U.S. Senate, their collegiality, their sense of entitlement and complacency, and so forth. Then we've even got Danny DeVito, from a drunk to a dry drunk. That's the third humiliation. And fourth, the Bush twins in Argentina told to get out after cavorting naked in the corridors of their hotel. The U.S. ambassador said, please get them out of here. And, of course, Maliki, on his side, actually had his motorcade stoned last week. So with Bush, everybody must get stoned, and there we have it. Now, concerning the perspective now, Bush, in all of his statements after the election, has made clear that he is committed to endless war, that there will be no change of policy. If anything, it is the Iraq study group that has been waffling on this. At this point, we have to look at two questions. One is the impeachment of Bush for 9/11 crimes, especially the misprision of treason. And secondly, the possible application of the 25th Amendment, that Bush is obviously non compos mentis. Let's do the 25th Amendment first, because this is a possible escape hatch from this situation. In the 25th Amendment, Section 4, we read, whenever the Vice President and the majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or some other body transmits to the President pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting President. Now, unless and until Dick Cheney has been given the Spiro Agnew treatment, something much to be hoped for as a Christmas gift, this does not get us too far. It also implies a degree of Republican rebellion against Bush, which we do not have so far. Rather, we have to look at the scenario we've talked about in previous weeks, the subpoena duces tecum scenario, which is that people like Leahy and Dodd and Waxman and other aggressive Democratic committee chairs in the House and the Senate essentially go at the Bush administration demanding testimony, demanding documents, duces tecum, you show up and you bring those documents with you. The Bush administration, animated by their fascist theory of the unitary executive, say no. They stonewall. Contempt of Congress citations result. A constitutional crisis results. And impeachment is the result, especially under conditions of ongoing military defeat in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is, I think, a possibility. It's more possible now than it ever was, because it looks like the base that Bush has had in the House and the Senate among those Republicans is eroding because of their desire to separate themselves from this lunatic policy. But let's look at the role that the 9/11 truth movement ought to play in this. First of all, it is clear, and we've talked about it, that a certain group of experienced politicians in the Democratic Party have traditionally seen a possibility of attacking Bush on 9/11 to somehow shift the political situation in their favor. It is through a limited hangout on the nonfeasance and catatonia of Bush during August of 2001, and especially on the day of 9/11. We've got a new example of this just from this past week. Here we go with GQ magazine. Interview Vice President Gore. Al Gore, remember, the left alternative to Hillary Clinton, in many ways the most dangerous politician of them all, because he represents the demagogic Malthusian alternative to Hillary Clinton. And Gore says in this interview, it is inconceivable to me that Bush would read a warning as stark and as clear as the one he received in the presidential daily briefing on August 6th. That's, of course, the one bin Laden determined to attack in USA. And goes on Gore, according to some of the new histories, Bush turned to the briefer and said, "You have covered your ass." Gore continued, never called a follow-up meeting, never made an inquiry, never asked a single question to this day. I don't understand it. And he goes on, but damn it, what happened to the concept of accountability for catastrophic failure? This administration has been by far the most incompetent, inept, and with more moral cowardice, obsequiousness, obliviousness, and so forth in the entire history of the U.S. This is the obvious limited hangout on this topic, which is there. Gore had already said something quite similar in May of 2006, standing at Vanity Fair magazine. Howard Dean had said something along the lines of Bush knew in advance to Diana Rehm, December 2003. The Harper's Magazine whitewash cover of October 2004 is all about this. Senator Bob Kerry had lamented that John Kerry had not used this approach to attack Bush in the debates of the 2004 election campaign. And, of course, more recently, we've had the Clinton exchange with Chris Wallace. I tried and failed. They never even tried, in October of this past year. And Hillary Clinton repeating the same thing pretty much along the lines of what Gore said. We've also got Bill Maher, the comedian, to Scarborough. If you unpack, he was did nothing. So there is clearly a living option on the Democrats seem to be in Marlboro saying that Bush should be impeached because the country was a risk, and he did taking this up. Because what is the ability of the 9/11 truth movement to exploit, to widen, to make a limited hangout into an unlimited and uncontrollable hangout? I will tell you the key. The key is Angel is next. The most important piece of political evidence of the entire day. Forget about your technical arguing points. Focus on the political evidence. Overwhelmingly, the most important political indication, Angel is next. Why? It is the invisible government, the actual authors of 9/11 from inside the U.S. bureaucracy, delivering an ultimatum to Bush, telling him what it is that he must do. We have to wonder, why is Angel is next ignored by the overwhelming majority of studies on 9/11? Some people accept the half-hearted denial made by the White House and an anonymous written statement in the middle of the night. This is absolutely inadequate. Angel is next came in, of course, with a cascade of top-level code and secret code words that indicated that the people making the threat represented the top levels of all of the main bureaucracies of the U.S., from the Pentagon to the CIA to the DIA to the NSA to the Treasury and so on across the board. Why has the 9/11 truth movement failed to exploit this obvious fact? And again, this is an official fact. Condoleezza Rice has discussed it on television, on Sunday morning talk shows in September 2001. William Sapphire wrote about it in the columns of the New York Times. Everybody knows that the leak was inspired by Cheney. It's fine to be somebody who hates Bush, but don't hate Bush so much that you're blinded by the hate and that you think that this is simply a means of covering up for Bush. There's something much more to it. That would be one. Angel is next. The other one would be the Bush-Putin telephone call. Again, completely ignored by most studies of 9/11 that tend towards the apolitical and therefore towards the impotent. And of course, after that point, we can bring in the catatonia argument. But if you're going to talk about recognized institutional mainstream facts, Angel is next. And any discourse on 9/11 that does not feature Angel is next, I think, is condemning itself to apolitical impotence and irrelevance. And I'm interested to see people somehow change their tune on this important issue. Now, let's look at what happens if these changes are not made. In other words, the argument I've just tried to put forward is that Bush is obdurate. Bush is hanging tough. He wants endless war. He's, of course, a schizophrenic. He's autistic. He's megalomaniac. He doesn't listen to facts. Cut off from the world, dry drunk. The whole argument that you can read in my schizophrenia chapter in 9/11 Synthetic Terror. So therefore, the only way to end the war in Iraq is going to be the impeachment of Bush for misprision of treason, along with Cheney, along with a bunch of the rest of them, and therefore you need the political approach starting from these overwhelmingly critical facts that have the advantage of being in the public domain. Now let's look at the alternative, the encirclement and annihilation of U.S. forces. A very interesting website called Global Guerrillas by John Robb. This guy seems to be a utopian strategist, certainly, but an intelligent one. And he writes that the U.S. forces, as of late September, are surrounded in Iraq by a sea of insurgents and militias. The opposition is improving in quality and quantity much faster than any puppet forces can be trained. And he says the obvious option for the Muqtada Sadr Mahdi army and or the Badr brigades in southern Iraq is to place what he calls lightly manned defensive hedgehogs along the supply lines or near U.S. bases. These hedgehogs are simply all directions, defensive positions where you can dig in and get supplied and cut off the, in this case, cut off the U.S. supply line, that critical 400-mile supply line from Kuwait to Baghdad. If you do this, he says, if you set up these lightly manned defensive hedgehogs cutting the supply lines, the U.S. forces will be forced to dedicate exclusively their energies to their own force protection, and the U.S. forward bases will be in danger of being overrun. Now, let's look at this critical southern Iraqi area. Patrick Coburn points again in a more recent column to the 400-mile Kuwait to Baghdad highway, where the U.S.-British position is becoming extremely tenuous. The British had 48,000 troops in southern Iraq at the height of it. The British now have 7,000 troops, and they are leaving fast. We have statements in the past couple of weeks from Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. We have them from Des Brown, the British Defense Secretary, and from Margaret Beckett, the British Foreign Secretary, that the British forces are going to be out within a matter of months. At that point, the British presence will go from almost 50,000 to zero. The Italians had 1,800 forces. They are out as of today. This is the Prodi government. He ran on this, and now he's doing it. We're also, it's important to realize the Ukrainians were about 1,700. They're gone. The Dutch were 1,300 plus. They're gone. The Spanish, 1,300. They're long gone. The Poles, 2,400. They are in the process of leaving completely this month. The South Koreans are going from 3,300 to 2,600. So, in effect, this entire critical supply line area is now going to be as vulnerable as can be. And the only thing we hear from U.S. generals is let's get more and more forces into the Baghdad pocket. This is an impossible situation. And remember, again, same thing applies to Afghanistan. The critical road from Peshawar through the Khyber Pass can become the aorta that is going to be cut. Encirclement and annihilation. There's a massacre reported in Ramadi. There's a big battle going on for the control of Bakuba. This is sort of in the area west, north, and east of Baghdad. Anbar province is reported completely lost. There are 30,000 Marines already there. They're being defeated. The generals are talking about another 3,000 Marines to be sent to Anbar. This will obviously make no difference, and there are even conflicting reports about whether they're going to be put into Anbar or taken out. Let us just address for a second the question of whether this is a civil war. Well, of course, it is a civil war. Historical fact allows us to go back to the French Wars of Religion. Not much discussed, but highly relevant. Society not so different from current Iraq. This would be France from 1562 to 1629, and it is a period where you have the Huguenots fighting against the Catholics and also against the monarchy. Let's just recall a couple of things. This included the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre of 1572, a massacre of Huguenots by the Catholics. It included the War of the Three Henrys, the Guise, Navarre, and Valois Henrys. One of them becomes King Henry IV. The famous Paris is worth a mass. And we'll be back to make the connection in just a second here on World Crisis Radio. Back on World Crisis Radio, Webster G. Tarpley, your host from Washington, D.C. A couple of more notes on this question of, is Iraq in a civil war? It is, precisely on the model of the French War of Religion, 1562 to 1629, when we count nine civil wars, including the big one, the War of the Three Henrys, from which Henry IV, the most beloved of all the French kings, Le Bon Henri, emerged. This is the guy who coined the famous slogan, put a chicken in every pot. The Spanish army intervened. At a certain point, Henry IV had to convert to become a Catholic. He said, fine, Paris is worth a mass. And eventually this thing was solved through the Edict of Nantes, which said everybody should be tolerated and the religious rights of these Protestant Huguenots will be respected. Let me just read what R.R. Palmer, pretty well-known historian of the past century, writes about this in his well-known and widely read History of the Modern World. He says, exact history distinguishes nine civil wars in the end of the 16th century in France. They were not civil wars of the kind where one region of a country takes up arms against another, with each retaining some apparatus of government, such as the American Civil War or the civil wars of the 17th century in England with Cromwell. These were civil wars of a kind fought in the absence of a government. Roving bands of armed men, without territorial base or regular means of subsistence, wandered about the country fighting and plundering, joining or separating from other bands in shifting hosts that were quickly formed or quickly dissolved. The underlying social conditions, the incessant rise of prices, detached many people from their old routines and made it impossible for small gentry or wage workers to live on their incomes. And thus, these people were thrown into a life of adventure. The more prominent leaders could obtain followers, and the coming of such cohorts drove the peasants into the woods while the bourgeois would lock the gates of their cities. But the peasants then formed protective leagues like vigilantes, and small towns maintained diminutive armies. This sounds exactly like what you have in Iraq today. Notice the importance of the economic breakdown as the precondition for the entire thing. Now, just a couple of quick notes. In Lebanon, notice that the Hezbollah is using the typical CIA methods of people power and the color revolution in reverse. And they are joined by General Michel Aoun. Most coverage doesn't talk about the fact that the most famous and most admired of all the Maronite Christians, General Aoun, is an integral part of this camping out now in Martyr Square in Lebanon, demanding the ouster of the puppet Signora government. And the point that General Aoun and Hezbollah are making is that Signora, the prime minister, is actually a puppet of the U.S. ambassador, Feltman. And the immediate issue is, will there be this crazy witch-hunting committee which is designed to come in and accuse Syria of having killed the former politician Hariri, when everybody knows that the Mossad had a death squad network operating in Lebanon at the time. We'll just wrap up our briefing with a couple of other notes, and then we'll get Maria Heller about 10 minutes into the coming hour here on World Crisis Radio. We'll be right back. Network in Webster Isis. Get SETO here on Republic Broadcast Network. Your host, Walter Tilly from Washington, D.C. On here minutes, let me just finish up. What General Aoun done in Lebanon is to take people power revolution and the forces, the pro-Feltman this past week. They have filled Martyrs Square and they're staying there until the puppet Signora regime quits, because it's time for Signora to go. Remember, this is a government that pays 75% of its income to the International Monetary Fund on debt service on international debt, and that is simply too much. And again, General Aoun, if you want to think of the De Gaulle of Lebanon, that would be General Michel Aoun, somebody who he got on top of the presidential palace in past years and dared the Syrians to come and kill him. Anyway, he is quite an interesting person. And this is now a key moment where the clash of civilizations is completely undercut in Lebanon by the Maronite Christian and really Lebanese nationalist, because that's what he is, Lebanese patriot Aoun, joining with Hezbollah in the streets against the government supported by the U.S. embassy. And again, it's a little bit like Kiev in December 2004, except it's in reverse. Aoun has taken up the orange color as his symbol. They have a slogan, U.S., meaning us, but according to some accounts, if you read that in Arabic, you can interpret it as meaning we want clean government. So an interesting creativity of Hezbollah and Aoun. Actually, Bolton at the UN says, why, this is a coup. Of course, when the U.S. does it in Belgrade, in Georgia, in Ukraine, it's people power, or in the Philippines, now it's been done in Philippines, as we heard last week from Mentong Laurel. That's just great. Now, of course, in London. This, of course, is a complete circus mafia that you're staged by British intelligence. Litvinenko belongs to Berezovsky, to Chalabi, to John R., the Nuremberg criminal who destroyed the Russian economy back on Litvinenko into the Yeltsin regime in the early 1990s. The thing I want to point out is that on 9/11, interview some time ago to the magazine Fakt, and here he's KGB, the Soviet FSB or KGB, basically runs all world terrorism. He says they ran Carlos the Jackal, they ran Saddam Hussein, they ran Arafat, they ran the PFLP, the Irish Republican Army. All of them are run by the KGB. And then he gets down to cases. He says, look, let's look at the right-hand man of Osama bin Laden. Let's look at Zawahiri. Zawahiri was an agent of the FSB, that is of the Russian KGB, through the Dagestan branch, and based on this, Litvinenko came up with the idea that the Kremlin is behind 9/11. The Kremlin brought down the buildings. Well, thanks to Pat Buchanan for noting that Putin is being set up, and even Keith Olbermann says the same thing. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. World Crisis Radio, Webster G. Tarpley, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. We're going to get our guest, Maria Heller, on in just a minute. Let me just make a comment here on the state of the 9/11 truth movement. We've always got to navigate between the two extremes of opportunism and sectarianism. As I tried to argue last week, the typical sectarianism is very often a technical point. Very seldom a political point, usually a technical point that somebody decides to make into the be-all and end-all of everything, and condemns anybody that doesn't share this particular technical point, which is somehow elevated to the touchstone of all wisdom. That's sectarianism, and that is a problem. We've also got opportunism, however, and opportunism, I think, would generally be a retreat from the general consensus on invisible government political myhop that we had gotten to by about the middle of 2006. I want to stress again the merit for the defeat suffered by Bush in the last election. The merit for this goes to the 9/11 truth movement and especially to the 8 hours of C-SPAN broadcasting of the Alex Jones panel from the conference there in Los Angeles at the end of June of 2006. The atmosphere of that panel discussion was, all in all, myhop, made it happen on purpose. That is, that the attacks came from a network inside the U.S. federal government and the banking establishment more directly. Now, if we compare that one to the C-SPAN performance that took place the past week, that is this meeting held in Berkeley with a number of leading spokesmen for our movement, I would say that the level of clarity on the critical question, which is the myhop question, the political myhop question, has somehow become blurred. And I think this means that the time on television is not being used to full effect. I think one of the grave dangers that faces the movement is that of scholasticism. Scholasticism means, in general, that you do not look at reality, but you look at reality allegedly as it has been embalmed in some text. It used to be Aristotle, I suppose, but now it's the Kane Hamilton 9/11 Commission report. The problem is that if you focus everything on the Kane Hamilton Commission report, you're not going to make enough progress vis-a-vis reality to know what is actually going on. I think the tendency in this Berkeley meeting was to continuously beat the dead horse of the Kane Hamilton Commission report and not broaden the debate in ways that are absolutely imperative at this time. Peter Dale Scott in the debate said that he thought that there were parts of the Kane Hamilton Commission report that were accurate and good and parts of it that were not reliable, and that we should somehow pick and choose inside the Kane Hamilton report, try to use the parts that are more successful against the parts that are less successful, and try to proceed in this way. The problem with this is you'll never get out of the Kane Hamilton Commission report. And generally speaking, overwhelmingly, the truth is located outside of this completely compromised text. Remember, Able Danger, even the Weldon Limited hangout, was ignored by Kane Hamilton. The Tenet Kofor Black Condoleezza meeting, reported on by Bob Woodward, ignored. The NORAD perjury, ignored. They say so themselves. And, of course, the drills, largely ignored. I would say that in the debate at the Berkeley meeting, a tremendous problem is that the drills were never mentioned. Nothing about the air defense suppression drills, nothing about the nuclear drills, nothing about the National Reconnaissance Office drill, crashing planes into buildings, nothing about Amalgam Virgo, even though that is one of the very few that came up in the hearings, at least, of the commission. Nothing on Angel is Next. And then we get to the reductio ad absurdum of the entire thing, Sergeant Ali Mohammed. Now, we've had Peter Lance in this past week, someone that I regard as an unreliable analyst, Peter Lance interviewed by Amy Goodman. Peter Lance obviously thinks that Sergeant Ali Mohammed is an evil terrorist who's been able to penetrate the U.S. federal government. And I'm afraid if we look at what Peter Dale Scott had to say in that Berkeley meeting, it sounds very similar. Peter Dale Scott spoke of the scandal of how Ali Mohammed's terrorism was tolerated by the U.S. government. So it turns out that Ali Mohammed is a tolerated terrorist. Now, this, of course, is bin Laden's personal assistant. Peter Dale Scott, of course, cites lots and lots of interesting facts about Ali Mohammed, some that I did not know, but some sort of prestige arsenal in the same that a hydrogen bomb would be, or a crack carrier group, a bad group, or a tank division. Ali Mohammed's tentacle seems to miss the fact that Ali Muhammad is not tolerated. Ali Muhammad is part of the U.S. this imperialist system. He is a controlled asset. He is a patsy or terrorist controller, as the case may be. So I think it is imperative now that the beating of the dead horse of the Kane-Hamilton Commission report somehow be at least supplemented to a significant degree, using the time wisely, with a hypothesis. What happened? Who did it? And again, the questions are, if you don't see it as MIHOP, if you're not willing to put forward consistently and thoroughly and even implacably the idea that this was the handiwork of a network inside the U.S. government, what are you doing? If you don't indicate that it's the rogue network inside the U.S. government that did it, you're essentially accepting the enemy's worldview. In other words, that there really is terrorism out there, they really want to do these things, and they really will come after you if you let them. That's number one. If you say that the problem is that the Bush administration doesn't wage the war on terror correctly, then you're falling right into the hands of Hillary Clinton or Al Gore right behind them. And the third question, which I think is absolutely decisive, if you don't focus on the drills as the way in which these things occurred, if you don't focus on the drills, you therefore don't know where the next attack is coming from. Because believe me, it's not coming from bin Laden in the cave, it's not coming from Hezbollah, it's coming from Cheney's office. And I think these are the kinds of points that can be effective as we go into a situation where, as I've tried to point out, the impeachment of Bush is now a definite possibility, but it's not going to occur unless the 9/11 truth movement gets a degree of theoretical clarity on this and uses precious television time to the maximum effect. So we can talk about this again, and we can also talk about how we've got to essentially convince the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives that they should not be attempting to enact the recommendations of the Kane-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission. They should be in the process of throwing out the Kane-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission and replacing it with a new and better investigation. Anyone would be better than the one that we've had. Now, let me ask the studio, do we have our guest on the line? Are we here?
I'm here.
Oh, Maria, how are you? Good. Come on. Wonderful. I'm joined by Maria Heller. People know her from her internet radio program, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome her. She's somebody who has been very kind to me over the years, who had very nice words about my book when it first came out, and was instrumental in helping me to make that book known to many readers, Maria, around the world. So we're joined by Heller.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, Webster.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, I guess we try to devote our second hour here to the state of the 9/11 truth movement. So I guess maybe I could start off by asking you, what do you think that all looks like from your point of view?
Well, from my point of view, and I've had some people, you know, basically come to me from the 9/11 movement, to me, it's stalled. You know, there's no better way to say it. It's stalled. It's as though everybody keeps talking about the same old things, which by now we're all convinced of. You know, the great conspiracy is the official story of 9/11. We all know, you know, what's in your book, what's in so many other people's books. I think that what we need to focus on now is, what do we do about it? How do we demand accountability? And I think that's what a lot of people are questioning now. You know, it's enough already about, you know, all these other things that, you know, your book so excellently points out, and so many other people. It's, what do we do about it? To me, impeachment is a waste of time. We need to push for trials on all these people for treason. And we need to make sure that there's a way that we can put them all in jail, even if it takes as long as it took to put Pinochet away.
Well, let me tell you what my objection to that would be: the following, that you have a much better chance of getting an impeachment verdict out of a political branch of government under conditions of breakdown than you do when you're facing the federal judiciary. Because we've got to remember, if we look back to the 1930s, Franklin D. Roosevelt in the New Deal found that the most reactionary, the most fascist branch of government was the Supreme Court. And the only way to deal with that is either to pack them or to impeach them or to get them out somehow or scare the hell out of them, which is what was eventually done. If you go into the federal courts today, you have a pre-constituted fascist majority against you at every level, all the way up to Scalia and Alito and the rest of them. And when people say, let's go into the courts, to me, I would have to say that's the most difficult means of all. You have a much better chance to stampede the House of Representatives under certain circumstances, which you can, again, try to begin to see right now with the lost war. And we'll be back in a second with Maria Heller here on World Crisis Radio. Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C., and we're talking with Maria Heller out in the great Southwest, as I recall. Maria Heller, of course, a very well-known internet radio broadcaster over the years, one of the leading figures in the 9/11 truth movement. She gave a very important one of the principal speeches at the Chicago 9/11 Truth Conference back in early June. That was the conference, I think, which put the entire movement on the track to deliver this tremendous defeat to Bush in the form of the November elections. And we were just talking to Maria about what the 9/11 movement should do at this point, where to go from here. Is it time to seek political remedies, or is it time to seek judicial ones? Maria, tell us more.
Hi, Webster. Well, I would say that the time to try remedies will not seek political. I mean, this much courage is long over. I mean, some Russian and both sides of the same party, whether they call themselves Democrats or Republicans. You know, Nancy Pelosi made it very clear that she wasn't going to push for impeachment, and surprisingly, so did John Conyers. So, again, people have to understand all these people will get paid by the same lobbyists. You know, they're all on the same agenda. And what disappoints me is even those that professed that they would address 9/11, that's a topic that's gone away from, you know, all their promises of what they're going to do. So, you know, judicial-wise, it's still difficult because, as you said earlier, you know, if we have a Supreme Court with packed judges, you know, five of which are Roman Catholics, three of which are Opus Dei, you'll have to say, well, you know, what are they going to do for the American people? So, you know, people ask me, Webster, and, you know, the thing I can think of is, you know, I always go back to the Declaration of Independence, which is, you know, when your government no longer serves the people have the right to create a new government. And I think that we're at that stage now because our government does nothing but lie to us. And, you know, your book is to me, a textbook that, and if they did, the free America would change on America. America needs to read.
It's kind of effective.
I get the whole world in it.
Well, I've tried to outline the perspective of how somebody like Pelosi, I certainly agree with your estimate of Pelosi, that she certainly doesn't want to do any of these things, and neither does Conyers want to do them. But we can imagine that these institutions have been designed by that fine Italian hand of Machiavelli, which is where I see them ultimately coming from, through John Adams, and that ultimately if Pelosi finds that all of her legislation is vetoed, as it's likely to be, that the one way that she can prove that there's some reason for her to exist will be to hold these oversight hearings and demand that characters like Bolton or Cheney show up and testify, and they're going to stonewall. They're going to say no. They're going to say, I'm not coming and I'm not bringing the documents and blankety-blank to you. And at that point, you do get into this contempt of Congress, you get into constitutional crisis, and a dynamic towards impeachment, which is obviously in contradiction to what Pelosi wants, but is somehow the product of the institutions themselves. In other words, that is the benefit of these institutions, if you will, that if you channel conflict into them, that's how they can work. If you don't have conflict into them, they don't work.
Right, but don't you feel that if we were to impeach George Bush, then Cheney becomes the open president of the country?
Well, we've always been careful to point out that we want him to get the Spiro Agnew treatment in advance.
Oh, that would be nice.
Well, it's been done. It's been done to Spiro Agnew, and it can be done to Cheney. And Cheney is, you know, he's more indictable than Spiro Agnew ever was. And he's also much more hated than Spiro Agnew ever was. So the kind of situation that I'm seeing right now is that you've got to look at what's going on in the ruling class. In other words, if the ruling class were united, it would be hopeless, as you say. But you do have this apparent split between the moderate imperialists of the James Baker stripe and the extreme fascist imperialists of the George Shultz stripe, because he's the one who backs up Cheney and the rest of these people. And that out of that conflict, there's an opening. In other words, it's a conjunctural perspective also that depends on this question of the dollar collapsing, which tends to make all of their problems much worse. So it seems to me that political action is probably better in its chances than judicial, because the judicial seems to me to be completely hopeless. But the other thing, of course, is mass action, and that's the thing that I think is important is the candidates movement that we've just had. In other words, I would urge everybody to get ready for the candidates movement in 2008, because when you go out there and you're agitating like mad on 9th, that has a real effect. If you're spending money to pay lawyers and write legal briefs that will be thrown away, it's just pointless, right? Or to make petitions to the federal government. I don't see what this is going to get you if you expect them to give you some specific answer. And here I go rattling on and on. We'll be back in just a minute. We're going to let Maria Heller talk, and we're going to let her answer questions. If you have some phone calls, we'll entertain them. 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. Back in a minute. Radio here on Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN Live, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. We're talking with Maria Heller, the very well-known internet radio personality broadcaster. Maria, before we go any further, you've got to tell us how people can listen to your broadcasts and how they can generally keep in touch with the important work that you do.
Well, it's easy. They need to go over to my website, which is Maria, MERIA.net. There's always a free show and an iPod download available, and they can support the show with subscription of their choice. And I have over 2,000 shows, and lots of them with you, Webster, on site for re-listening any time of the day or night. So it's very exciting. I've got all the best 9/11 people there, and I've excluded those that I don't think do the movement any good. So if you want real straight-up answers, that's the place to go.
So that's www.meria.net, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, that's it.
Okay, wonderful. www.meria.net and an archive so you can actually reconstruct the history, a lot of this stuff, if you want to.
Absolutely.
Well, how do you see then the political moment in general? What's your general outlook? War, peace, dictatorship, freedom?
I can tell you this. We are moving so rapidly into a police state that I can't imagine that the average American can't see it. I think that with the Democrats taking this election, it's just going to create a delay in the inevitable. I'm not, you know, putting my hopes and faith in them making anything different. You know, and it's reading books like yours and so many others like Rogue Nation, and et cetera, where you really understand how long this madness has been going on in our country and how ignorant we've been of the U.S. foreign policy, et cetera, and the goals of the One World Order minions, that it's just incredible to me. It's like the deeper you go, as you know, Webster, it's like the rabbit hole has no end. So I'm not, I don't have any really good feelings, I hate to say it. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've been following the elections and everything going on in Mexico. I mean, those people are physically throwing their bodies on the tables of Congress to stop an illegal president. And yet here, you know, with the in-our-face stolen election of 2000, everybody just decided to move on, and we did. We moved right on to 9/11. And from there, we've moved on to two innocent countries and the police state. So I don't know what we can move on to next, except maybe nuclear winter.
Well, there's always the attack on Iran, and then, of course, there's the huge anti-Russian, anti-Chinese campaign behind that. Maybe also Newt Gingrich talking about restricting the First Amendment, freedom of speech.
Well, that's
an interesting way to run for president.
Right, that's already been happening, you know that. I mean, we live in a climate of fear where people are afraid to even express their political opinions, you know, in a restaurant. For God forbid somebody overhears them and, you know, calls the cops on them as a terrorist. So, you know, it's very difficult even talking about 9/11 to someone. You know, you don't want to be overheard. It's as if we have to whisper our politics.
Right. Well, we do have a few things on the burners, though. I mean, I think 2 weeks from today or 2 weeks from this weekend, we've got this series of events in Boston for the Boston Tea Party for 9/11. And some other things that I think that's a kind of stunt that might make a difference. Whatever the theoretical content is, it might be enough of a media stunt to make some waves.
Right. Well, you know, we're going to have to pull some really big tricks. You know, I always think about that movie, V for Vendetta. You know, how great would it be if we could pop a movie into, you know, every satellite TV company out there, like maybe 9/11 Mysteries, where no one can change the channel and they're forced to see it. I think that America would turn around in a hot second and we would have a revolution on our hands, which we desperately need.
Right. Well, I think that is the idea, and that is, of course, what is implicit in the Declaration of Independence, that your rights belong to you, and you're allowed to assert them if the government tramples them. What other issues do you see as looming very large right now?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're as well aware of it as I am, that Iran is definitely on the table. And, you know, my own personal feelings is, you know, going into Iran would be a bigger mistake than Iraq. And, you know, Russia and China have been pretty vocal about us not hitting their business partner. And, you know, suddenly, you know, since we were young kids, all of a sudden now Russia's become the enemy again. So, you know, it's the dastardly days we live in, for sure.
Correct. Well, what is the way out? Is activism still possible? It seems to be.
Well, I mean, if we're not going to be in protest cages or, you know, arrested for, you know, exercising our rights, at least the rights we thought we had, I think that the only option we have now is a revolution. There is no other way. You know, and I don't think the American public have it in them. I really don't. You know, we can blame the media for that because they've put everybody into like a trance-like state. You know, very few people really know what's going on. And I think if they had the opportunity, they would act. There's no doubt in my mind. The basic American person is a good person, and if they knew the truth, they'd be up in arms. Because right now, we're in the same position we were when we tried to free ourselves from King George I. And now we have a new King George. who unfortunately happens to be as dumb as a rock. You know? And this is what we have as a president. You know, it's embarrassing, to say the least.
And now that there's always the 25th Amendment.
Now that they said English is the national language, I guess somebody's going to have to teach George Bush how to speak English. What goes around comes around. I think it's important to keep a sense of humor, and I know you know that too, because, you know, when you talk about such serious subjects, I think if we don't inject a little humor, it just frightens the average person down to their knees, because it's the ultimate horror to find out that your government's been lying to you your entire life, and that everything you see is an illusion. You know, it's made for you to buy the propaganda, and 9/11 was the greatest psyop ever pulled, I think, on the American public.
Well, just on that, though, if you look at the results of the last election, you'd have to say that in 2002 and 2004, the demagogy of terror, the reign of terror, the magic of terror seemed to work. In other words, Bush was able to pose himself as the Wizard of Oz behind the screen and extorted everybody's vote on the basis of terror. But somehow in 2006, this seems to have collapsed, at least to some extent. And I would interpret that vote, for me, it's the beginning of a party realignment of a very significant type. But it also, just on the surface, it repudiates Bush, the Republicans, but it also repudiates, I would say, the global war on terror, and the 9/11 myth itself, because right. I think that is what we've been able to accomplish, those of us in the movement here of the last several years, is that we've been able to tear down the myth to the point where the automatic Pavlovian reaction of, you know, you feel threatened, you vote for Bush or his minions, that simply didn't work. And I would say it really was a turning point away from total domination by fear, because right. as some people pointed out, Bush and Rove thought that the fear would work again, and somehow it didn't.
Well,
and somehow
what happens with the American public, you know what, if you keep telling them something over and over again, they get bored with it. And then they realize it's based on some subconscious level, and they've moved on from it. You know, they're just over it. That's the way I see it. And I can tell you, after this election, I got so many emails, so many phone calls, saying if it wasn't for you and your work and the people you have on your show's work, this couldn't have happened. And I really do believe that the internet community has done a tremendous amount to educate America. And I believe that the media for the masses, or should we say, you know, the masses for the asses, is copying and stealing news off our shows. You know, look how many years it takes them to get a story you and I might have covered, you know, 5 years ago. And to me, it's like, wow, they're finally covering that, and I, like, already forgot about it, you know. But I think they're realizing, and you can see it with all the major newspapers now wanting to, you know, buy into Google, et cetera. You know, the newspaper business is going down the tubes, because I think on a subconscious level, people know that they've been lied to. Now, if we can get them to understand that on a conscious level, then we've got something great going on.
I would also say that, indeed, the 9/11 Truth Movement does have the merit, and you know, what we were able to put on C-SPAN, in particular, in the middle of the summer, but also the appearances on lots and lots of programs, Stephen Jones going on Tucker Carlson a year ago, and many other broadcasts, that whenever these characters on cable television feel that they need a shot in the arm for their ratings, they get some 9/11 Truth spokesman on there and generate a clash about that, even including, you know, O'Reilly, Hannity, and people like that. So,
well, you find that on a lot of the left gatekeepers do the same thing. You know, they'll have some 9/11 people on, and then they'll shoot them in the foot, you know, unexpectedly, like Amy Goodman did to David Griffin, or parading the boys from Loose Change and trying to humiliate them with the two idiots from Popular Mechanics. But, you know, for the ratings, it's great, but they're not asking the real questions, and they're surely not talking to you and I. You have to try to sift through and say, you know, who, you know, what agenda are they really serving? You know, truth is truth, Webster, and even though the truth is painful, and I can tell you, reading your book was painful as an American, but I was so enlightened by it. And I think we have to put our fear aside of, you know, the real ugliness and understand it, because I think if we really got a grip on, you know, and I'm totally convinced that, you know, 9/11 was my hop. There's no doubt in my mind. You know, Richard Grove emailed me while we're talking and said, tell Webster it was my hop all the way. And that's all there is you have to say. But it's a hard thing for, you know, for me, you know, as a patriotic American, to have realized just how deep the rabbit hole goes and how long we've been duped. So, you know, people have to put their fear aside and do the homework. You know, we're supposed to be an informed citizenry. It's our duty to know what our government's doing.
Wonderful. I couldn't agree more. So if you want to keep abreast of 9/11 research and the state of the movement, no better place than www.meriamaria.net. And you can hear, what, programs live once a week, twice a week?
Well, I do a live show Monday to Thursday right now. I'll be expanding that in the next month. But every show I've ever done is there. There's over 2,000 shows on my site. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as I said, of course, Webster, several of your shows. And, you know, my listeners love you. I have tons of my listeners, you know, listening to the show right now. They're all popping questions up on my screen because I have my IM on. You know, people, I think, can tell the difference between who's got the goods and who doesn't. And we have to. It's our duty to tell our neighbors, tell our friends, tell anybody that'll listen what we know, and lose the fear, because they, okay. You know, it calls for it. Times call for it. We have no more time left. These people will totally annihilate the entire planet if we let them.
I agree. I always cite the slogan that I was taught by a rather venerable Spanish leftist: get active or get radioactive. And I think that sums up the human condition in our time. Mm-hmm. You want to take a couple of phone calls? Should
sure,
we see
why not?
what the Vox Populi is thinking tonight?
Sure, absolutely.
Here we go. How about Richard in Alabama? You're on with Maria Heller.
I've got a little idea. Stop saying the government. Instead, just say the 9/11 murderers, because practically everybody in the government understands, but they've moved on. They've understood that if you talk about it, you get fired. So they just decided to just move on to other agendas and forget 9/11. Now, another thing you can do, if every time you got an envelope to send back to a government about any subject, and they got the address pre-printed on there, write a comma right after their agency and said, comma, branch of the 9/11 murderers. Just add that on there. And court briefs, add a comma, branch of the 9/11 murderers, comma, court of the 9/11 murderers, comma, prosecutor for the 9/11 murderers. Just keep on, just let them, they know what they are. They've just moved on past the issue.
Well, I think that just putting 9/11 accountability would also do the trick on everything we send in the mail, because even the postman has to handle that envelope.
Well, everybody at the post office knows that our government did the 9/11 murder. Everybody agrees with it. Everybody. Nobody disputes it. Not even the postmaster believes otherwise. Everybody knows it's a fact. But the problem is, we're all waiting for the UN takeover, the phony revolution, and the United Nations blue helmets will march in. They're all sitting and waiting for the blue helmets.
Well, I would call them the September criminals, as I have done. The other thing is, if you go back to Germany in the 1930s, there are a lot of Germans who knew that Hitler and the Nazis had burned down the Reichstag. But it's safe to say that if Hitler and company had won the Second World War, all relevant history books today would say the Reichstag was burned down by the communist van der Lubbe and his crazy mentality. So therefore, there's a question of political power here. In other words, history is going to be written by the victors this time, too. So the question of what happens to these people is open-ended, right? There was a coup. They either were part of it or they supported it. But then if a counter-coup comes along, then that could all change.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody in the government is just sitting and waiting for the UN to take over, and they expect to just serve the UN the same as they served the original murderers.
You want to stress the United Nations. I think this maybe is not exactly the right place to look. I mean, if there's going to be martial law here, it's going to be carried out by the FBI and the U.S. Army, and pretty much they won't need too much help, will they?
That pretty well disgraced the Army. Nobody will love the Army anymore. After a few years of martial law, everybody will hate the American uniform and hate the flag. So when the U.N. marches in, half the country will cheer for them.
Okay, well, maybe we can head this off. Thank you, Richard from Alabama. Let's go on now to Michael in Arizona. Michael, you're on with Maria Heller here on World Crisis Radio.
Yeah, good afternoon, Webster. Hi, Maria. How you doing?
Hi, how
Hello
are
there.
You?
First of all, I want to say that...
The Telltale Music, The Heartbreak, The Computer is Pitiless. We'll be back in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We got our closing segment here, just a few minutes left. We're on the line with Maria Heller, leading internet broadcaster. You can keep in touch with Maria at www.meria.net. Maria.net, and we're just on the line with Michael in Arizona. Very briefly, Michael.
Yeah, well, first I just wanted to say that somebody should shove Newt Gingrich back in his cage, stick a sock in his mouth, and tell him to shut up. Anyhow, do either one of you know what Amalgam Virgo stands for, what it is?
Well, the exercise, of course, I read about this significantly. This did come up in the middle of the 9/11 hearings, actually, when they had open hearings. There were all kinds of questions and answers about Amalgam Virgo.
Meaning the Greek mythology for it.
Well, Virgo, the Virgin, of course, the constellation. The amalgam indicates that it's more than one country. But you go right ahead and tell us what you think.
I just wondered if you knew or not. I didn't know. It's Caiaphas bringing pyrotechnics upon commerce on the month of September is what it refers to.
Well, I think what it meant in reality was the practicing of firing a cruise missile from a barge or a freighter hitting a land target in the U.S. And I would view this as being the cover or the vehicle for what happened at the Pentagon. In other words, the firing of a missile or cruise missile of some kind at a stationary land target. This is Amalgam Virgo. It also
includes
hijackings of airplanes.
Well, my point is that see, we could debate it all day long, but the whole point is the buildings aren't there anymore, and somebody blew them up, didn't they? And nobody's going to tell us, you, me, or anybody else legally in this country who did it. So, you know, it'd be really easy to fix it. If nobody went to the stock market and nobody bought or invested in the stock market and nobody did anything for about 30 days, I think we could get their attention. We don't need a gun revolution. We just need to quit buying all their products and quit doing all their things for about 30 days. The American people have their attention real quick. You agree with that?
And you'd need an institution able to do that. What do you think, Maria?
I think that if everybody stops spending and supporting the multinational corporations and multinational banks for at least a month, we definitely get their attention. I think the only vote we have left is with our dollar.
So okay, we just have a couple of minutes left, Michael. I have to push on. We've got Dan Abramson calling in. Can we hear from Dan in our final moments?
Hey, what's up, Wes?
Very quickly, Dan.
I'll make it as quick as possible. I want to get Maria's opinion on two things. I watched the C-SPAN conference that was recently on, and I felt it was sort of a regression. They really failed to discuss the drills and the war games and Angel is Next and the NORAD team really becoming complicit for the NATO government, the LIHOP angle. And additionally, on the other end of things, what we have now is Jim Fetzer siding with the sectarians and pushing a bunch of radical fringe theories which don't even seem to survive the most basic questioning. So I'm wondering what you think of the rise of the sectarians, of these people that call Dr. Stephen Jones a liar, and the people that are trying to push the most fringe theories, as well as the most recent C-SPAN conference.
Well, you know, first of all, I don't care for anybody slamming Stephen Jones' work because I don't think they're at the same level of intelligence. And I don't have TV, so I don't have to worry about C-SPAN.
Okay, I think I tried to give a characterization of this before. I want to thank our excellent guest, Maria Heller, www.meria.net. You can hear her every day of the week, just about, or constantly in the archive shows. Thank you to our callers, and we'll be back next week here on World Crisis Radio. And don't forget about that Boston Tea Party coming up 2 weeks from now, more or less.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Maria.
Bye,
thank you
Lisa.
Again.
You too.